Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. For nearly a decade, the U.S. has used unmanned fighter planes called Predator drones to kill suspected terrorists. That policy has been sharply criticized, both at home and in countries where drones are deployed. But most military experts say drones are here to stay. Joining me in the studio to talk about U.S. counterterrorism and drones in warfare, Shane Harris of Washingtonian Magazine, Christine Fair of Georgetown University, Daniel Green of the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, and C. Dixon Osborne of Human Rights First. We'll welcome your calls a little later in the program. Join us on 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Join us on Facebook or Twitter. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Christine, I know you support the use of drones to fight terrorism. Tell us why.
Well, to be clear, I'm a proponent of the drone program in Pakistan, not necessarily drones elsewhere. The drone program in Pakistan is one that I've looked at quite a bit. It's also a program that has been really mischaracterized. So, for example, Pakistanis will say that we're there violating their sovereignty, but in point of fact, we're there on their air bases with their permission. One of the biggest problems has been the so-called civilian casualties. And again, this is something for the record, I used to be violently opposed to the drones in Pakistan until I began learning about the program. One of the things that I discovered in talking to Pakistani journalists, and you know, I spent a lot of time in Pakistan, I've talked to very high-level Pakistani military commanders as well as folks in our side, they're actually not killing these civilians, especially since 2008. And one of the problems with the federally administered tribal areas, which is where our drone strikes are required to remain, is that they have an unusual constitutional status, according to which journalists can't just go there. And so there's no independent confirmation of these hits. And one of the other realities of Pakistan's media is that it's really dominated by their intelligence service. They have a media wing. And as Pakistani journalists themselves have explained to me, anywhere between like as many as one in three Pakistani journalists are directly on their payroll, i.e. paid to plant stories. And so Pakistani journalists themselves have explained to me that what will happen is that there'll be a strike, and then either the ISI or the Pak Taliban will report this. And it's to their advantage to have these reports out there, because then the ISI uses it to calibrate their resistance to us. So this is the best of all worlds for the ISI, that they benefit from having these drones, which increasingly target what Americans will say are low-level terrorists, but they're, in fact, in many cases, Pakistan's own terrorists. So they get that benefit. But then they get the added benefit of using it as leverage against the Americans.
Christine Fair, she's at Georgetown University and a fellow at West Point's Combating Terrorism Center. Turning to you, Daniel Green, what countries are we using drones against? Isn't Libya also one?
Unfortunately, I just learned that this morning. But, I mean, it's just a platform that can be used for a variety of purposes. And though we most prominently know it from our experience in Afghanistan and Pakistan, there's no reason why we shouldn't be using it all over the world, and not just necessarily for targeted strikes, but for surveillance and just intelligence gathering in general. But it's just just one of many tools in our arsenal, if you will. And if it's in Libya, that's fine. If it's not, that's fine as well.
What about Somalia? What about Yemen?
Sure. There are a lot of news reports that indicate that those might be used over there. At the same time, the Yemenis allegedly have an air force that they use, but there are also ships in the area that might be using cruise missiles, things of that nature. So if they're there, that's good. If not, that's fine as well. And just another tool.
How effective do you believe they are?
Well, at least I know from Pakistan, a lot of insurgents are always looking to the sky, looking for things. I mean, it's definitely a very effective tool. Obviously, if one crashes, you're not losing an American life. You also, they're relatively inexpensive compared to some of our fighter jets and other tools. Yeah, so I think they're quite effective. But the problem is, or the challenge really, is you have to have a robust intelligence network there to help develop the target packages that the drones, you know, obviously are then used to engage.
Daniel Green, the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. Dixon Osborne, your thoughts.
For Human Rights First, we're not opposed to drones per se. That's a delivery mechanism. Nor are we concerned with targeted killing. In fact, the opposite of targeted killing would be indiscriminate killing. And so we want our armed forces to be targeted when it deploys lethal force. Our concern is whether or not the targeting complies with the rule of law. Under the laws of armed conflict, the people that you can use lethal force against are combatants or people who are directly participating in hostilities. I think there's an open question in U.S. policy what the criteria are that we're using in the targeting in Pakistan, Yemen, Somalia, and elsewhere.
What about the Pakistani reporting that Christine talked about and how closely that reporting is attached to the ISI?
Well, I think we have two issues to look at. One is the legality of it, and then the other is sort of the strategy and policy behind it. In terms of the legality, let's assume under the 2001 authorization for use of military force where we're going after al-Qaeda and the Taliban, just because they have tried to escape that conflict by going across the border does not render them less targetable. So one could argue that using drones to target those leaders who've been part of the authorization for use of military force in Afghanistan would indeed be targetable. The question is, and you do hear reports, and there's a question about the validity of those reports. Back in March, the New York Times reported about a hit on a jirga that was trying to resolve a dispute over mineral rights. And in the New York Times, it reported that there were 32 people there, of which 23 were civilians. And that created a huge uproar. I can't comment on the validity of that reporting, but the policy question is, no, if you target and kill 11 people who were legitimate targets, but you're creating 100 more insurgents, is that an efficacious policy?
C. Dixon Osborne, he's Director of Law and Security at Human Rights First. Shane Harris, I know there are a great many people, organizations who are absolutely opposed to the use of drones on moral grounds. How strong are their voices?
I think they're getting a lot stronger. At the beginning of this program, when so little was known about it, it was difficult to find, you know, the grounds on which to oppose it. That is not
so
much the case.
How far back does
going to about 2004 is where we basically start to measure the use of these drones with real significance for hitting targets, particularly in Pakistan, which is where the program is the most active. I mean, there are six countries where they're being used now, but really Iraq, Afghanistan, Pakistan, that's sort of the area. And Pakistan is really the controversial place where a lot of this opposition comes from. The start of that is because we're not really at war with Pakistan, are we? And that a state of war does not exist there, and that is generally considered the foundation for when the law of war comes into apply to how you conduct these hostilities. So there are some people who have argued, and I think persuasively now, to the point where it's caused the administration to come out publicly and state why it believes the drone program is legal. And the administration's position essentially boils down to this is a matter of self-defense, that we not only take great care to target the right people, minimize collateral damage, make sure we're hitting the right person, but that we're doing this essentially as self-defense. We're hitting these people, these terrorists and militants who are attacking U.S. troops in the region and who might be plotting attacks in the United States. I don't think that that has necessarily moved the needle when it comes to the opposition. And I think a lot of people who were opposed to the strikes were surprised to hear this administration take such a, you know, an aggressive posture on supporting drone strikes. But that is, in fact, now where they are publicly on it.
And do we have any correct or accurate information on how many civilians have accidentally been killed by these drone strikes?
Right. It's a difficult number for all the reasons that the other panelists have stated. Some of the numbers that generally tend to be cited are compiled by the New America Foundation, which has put together a pretty comprehensive list that a lot of journalists rely on. And what they've found is that from about 2004 to 2010, the number of civilian deaths did drop significantly. Their numbers say that in 2004, roughly one in four people killed was a civilian casualty, and now that the number is down to 6%. So if we take those numbers as as rigorous as we're going to get maybe of an analysis and impartial of an analysis, then it looks like the civilian casualties have dropped significantly. That said, every time a civilian is killed, it creates the opportunity for more opposition to the program, for alienating the public. I mean, the military is not interested in increasing the amount of civilian casualties. I think they and the CIA have probably taken steps to try and minimize that as much as possible. And the technology of the drones themselves helps them do that as well. These targetings can be very specific. The weapons can be very precise, and they will continue in the future to get even more so.
And the U.S. isn't the only country trying to develop them, make them more precise.
That's exactly right. I mean, there is something of a global drone race going on right now. It would be inaccurate to describe, you know, the U.S. as somehow in contention for first place with many countries. We're still quite far ahead, technologically speaking. But the Chinese have now announced their intentions. There was one of their biggest air shows recently. There was a story in the Washington Post about this yesterday where they are aggressively pursuing drones for combat. More than 50 countries right now have purchased surveillance drones that are not armed, but there is clearly a race to build these things, sure.
Shane Harris, he's senior writer for Washingtonian Magazine, author of the article Watchers, The Rise of America's Surveillance State. Short break, your calls when we come back. Welcome back. We're talking about the expanding use of drones, not only by the U.S., but being developed by other countries around the world. As Shane Harris, author of the book The Watchers, The Rise of America's Surveillance State, just mentioned, yesterday's Washington Post reported that China is now developing drones as well. So we're going to see an increase not only in development but in use. I wonder, going back to you, Christine Fair, we talked earlier in the program about the number of civilians. Shane Harris mentioned the New America Foundation and its numbers of civilian casualties. Do you accept that number?
I don't, and not because they haven't made a good faith effort to get the best possible number possible. The problem is junk in, junk out. The Pakistani media, there are a couple of areas where the reporting is really compromised. One is on Baluchistan. Another is on drones. And so what will happen, a drone strike will take place. Either the Pakistan Taliban or the ISI will put different reports out. And they're they're never the same report, right? There's always going to be this built-in error, so they look more precise, ironically. And there are no journalists that can go in and independently confirm these numbers. So the problem with the New America Foundation numbers is that it's the best possible, but the underlying data are deeply problematic. They did another survey of about 1,000 persons in the tribal areas. Unfortunately, that survey, while a good faith effort, was also empirically quite flawed. They were trying to ask people what they think about drones, but they didn't ask people whether or not they'd actually seen a drone. And my experience has been the people who have seen a drone personally have a very different experience of their accuracy.
Shane, give us a sense of what a drone looks like.
Sure. Well, imagine sort of an airplane with no windows on it, sort of a very sleek kind of design. Some of them are very large with a wingspan of more than 60 feet. Essentially, it just looks a lot like an airplane, like a very sort of slimline, stripped-down airplane. Many of them are driven by a turboprop propeller. They're not terribly sophisticated in that regard. But the armed drones are really the ones that we're talking about here, and these are capable of carrying Hellfire missiles, which can be targeted at individuals or at compounds. They are piloted remotely, perhaps by somebody who is sitting nearby at a base in country or on the other side of the world in the United States. Really, they don't look all that remarkable or particularly deadly, frankly, when you see them in photographs.
But they are deadly.
They are,
and I wondered too about the people operating those drones from either a next country nearby or from the United States, and how they feel about sending those drones up.
Yeah, it's a really good question, and there's research now that's coming out suggesting that, you know, the effects of PTSD that one would normally experience in combat are not that drone operators are not immune to that. It's also important to note that when we're talking about flying a drone, it's more than just one person sitting in this sort of disembodied cockpit with a hand on a stick. There are more than 100 people who attend every one of these drone strikes in some capacity, whether it's analysts who are looking at the extraordinary amounts of information that these drones can collect about the target, whether it's the operators, the maintenance crew. The lawyers take up a very large number of people as well, because these strikes are so closely monitored by that community. So there really is a whole sort of network of people involved in piloting a drone, if you want to use that term, that is not the same kind of situation that you would find necessarily in manned aircraft. It's a different kind of calculation, but there are a lot of people involved.
Daniel Green, what about Yemen? What's going on there? How effective is the use of drones in Yemen? And do we know about casualties?
Most famously, there was a UAV strike on the head of Al-Qaeda in 2002, which effectively decapitated their organization. And for a variety of reasons, that sort of made them inactive for a number of years. There were a lot of other reasons that contributed to that. Yemen, the Al-Qaeda and Yemen forces were focused on the Iraq war. There's a lot of open media talks about there being an increase in focus on counterterrorism operations in Yemen. But the thing about all this we have to remember is the drone is just a tool. It's the intelligence infrastructure that makes it accurate or inaccurate. And that's the real deciding factor in all these things. You can be for or against drones. It's just a tool. And for every drone strike in Pakistan, there are months, if not years, of yeoman work being done by human intelligence sources and a variety of other means that develop those target packages, as they're often referred to. So that's really a lot of this debate is, like, what is the fidelity or what confidence do we have in the intelligence infrastructure that provides those targets?
You said you were surprised to learn that you had just learned this morning that the U.S. is using drone strikes in Libya. Are you surprised?
No, not really. I mean, it's just another front that's using another tool in our arsenal. I mean, I'm not so outraged as some might be that we're using drones in other parts of the world. It's just one of a number of tools that we're using. And frankly, if you're trying to minimize casualties, not just on the civilian side, but among your own troops, you know, using drones can certainly facilitate that. You're not going to lose a pilot. You don't have to have a whole infrastructure as well that's there to rescue that pilot if he's downed, or, you know, that will bring other Americans' lives at risk if they come in country.
Dixon, how do you feel about the use of drone strikes in Libya?
Well, I think the question in Libya as well as Yemen is what is the operating rules that are governing us? Shane mentioned that one of the reasons that the government is invoked is self-defense or security, but that means that you have to have an imminent security threat to be able to take lethal force outside of a declared armed conflict. And I think there are critics out there that are concerned that we're deploying drones not to combat imminent security threats. So that is something that I think the administration needs to continue to explain further about why it is using drones in these different areas.
Here's an email from Fredericksburg, Virginia. Roland says the use of remote control robotic killing machines is very impersonal, takes emotion out of the equation. It's like a video game where you kill real people without seeing the consequences of collateral damage, which is often women, children, and the occasional wedding party. Christine, you're shaking your head no.
No, I'm not. I mean, I think there's another distinction that we haven't talked about yet on this panel, and there are really two kinds of drone strikes. One is the Department of Defense, military strike. And those, there's considerable transparency. You can find on YouTube, for example, in Afghanistan, when troops come into contact and they call in air assets, if it's a drone, they'll bring their ordnance. And we can see on YouTube some of the outcomes of that. You then have the intelligence-led, which are, even though they're no longer covert, they're still called covert, which is where we have no transparency. But this is where the public doesn't appreciate that there are cameras on these things. There are hundreds of people that are involved in the collection of a target. They are watching the entire process of targeting to the actual conduct of the explosion, and then they're also surveying the aftermath. And so this idea that somehow this is just remote control 14-year-olds at the Nintendo or the Donkey Kong is simply untrue. And when you talk to people that are involved in this, they are real pilots actually behind the drone program experiencing the real stress of combat.
Shane.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, this is something that's not just sort of fire and forget. You see the effects of it, and they lead up to it for days and weeks. Something the emailer said was this idea of these robotic killing machines. I mean, one of the things that people who look at this deeply are becoming more concerned about is not just that the number of drones is proliferating, but that we are trying to make them more autonomous, that is able to go out and fly around by themselves, to land and take off by themselves, to act independently of control from a human being. And while the military will swear up and down that they would never build a drone that actually had the autonomy to go out and select a target and fire on it itself, there is research going on right now in the Defense Department to do precisely that. Whether or not we will entirely let the fleet, go off by itself and pick its own targets versus saying, go out and find the best way to kill it, is sort of, splitting hairs a bit. We are moving to this point where we are creating robotic machines that go out and conduct warfare quite independently of us.
Dixon, how has the use or the number of uses of drones changed between the Bush administration and the Obama administration?
The use of drones has increased dramatically under the Obama administration.
Dramatically.
Yes. But that's also in part because it is a tool that has been developed more recently and in much greater numbers. It's also because of, a concerted decision that this is the way that they want to prosecute the conflicts that we are engaged in.
Aren't you worried that as more widespread development comes, more widespread use will come even into this country?
Well, I think that is part of the debate that's going on. And when you're highlighting sort of the globalization of the drone market, what is the debate going to be when nations determine that other nations are terror targets and you have North Korea flying drones into South Korea or China flying drones into Taiwan? What that underscores is that we really need to make sure that we are following the rule of law, that if it's an armed conflict, there are certain rules that guide our decisions. If it is an imminent security threat for a nation, there are rules that guide those decisions. But those debates are need to continue to happen.
But we haven't declared war on Libya. nor has Libya been declared an enemy of the United States.
Right. And so one of the concerns in the self-defense scenario is just because you're a member of a terrorist organization does not mean that you're a target for lethal force. There needs to be an imminent security threat. And this is where the administration really needs to clarify how it is targeting individuals.
Shane.
Yeah, the Libya case provides a really good example of the complexities of this because, I mean, we can't even agree, the administration can't seem to agree whether there are actually hostilities going on in Libya right now. There's been a lot of reporting on this. There were some who advocated, in fact, pulling back the drones so that we could more legitimately claim that we were not engaged in hostilities. The president reportedly made the determination that, I guess, drone strikes don't quite cross that threshold. So, I mean, you see where all of this really does boil down to definition, to circumstances, but yet we're using them in more countries now than we would have ever anticipated 4 years ago, I think.
Shane Harris, senior writer for Washingtonian Magazine, author of Watchers, The Rise of America's Surveillance State. We'll take a short break, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. We're going to open the phones now. 800-433-8850. First to Rita in Cleveland, Ohio. Good morning. You're on the air.
Thank you. I would like to suggest the golden rule. What makes us think they're not going to be raining down on us? What makes us so smug to think that we can invent this horror and we're not going to get it back?
Christine.
Well, I think, first of all, we have to realize that there are a lot of non-state actors who are already using drones. So, for example, I remember Peter Singer in his volume about drones, he discussed Hezbollah's use of drones against the Israelis in the 2006 war. You may be familiar with the narco cartel's use of drones, as well as, most interestingly, unmanned submarines to move their stuff around. What I find most interesting about drones is that we get obsessed with their high end, the sorts of stuff that defense contractors would wheel and deal. But in fact, by way of a technology, there's a lot at the lower end of the pyramid. All you really need is an enthusiast model of a remote piloted aircraft. You can do a lot with the kinds of enthusiast aircraft that you can find on eBay. You just stick a camera on it. So, I think that this way of warfare is the way it's going to be. And as with all military technologies, we're going to see all sorts of spin-offs. You know, I kind of think about the days when we were introducing tank warfare, and there were the guys with their horses who didn't want to let go of the cavalry. And we can go back and we can find their arguments for keeping the horses. But, you know, guess what? We went the way of tank warfare. And so I think not only drones, but we're also looking at robots that can go in and help take or extract wounded soldiers from the battlefield so that they're freeing up their buddies.
But
this is the way of the...
Go back to the caller's question. What makes us so smug as to think that these might not be raining down on us, Shane?
I don't think we do think they might not be raining down on us. I mean, I think that the United States military is keenly aware of the Chinese advancements in this area, the Russian advancements. They know that this is something of an arms race and that could very easily be turned against us, sure.
Thanks for calling, Rita. Let's go now to Richmond, Indiana. Good morning, Jim.
Morning, Diane.
Hi there.
Listen to your show about every morning.
I'm glad.
I don't agree with a lot of things that go on your show, but that's just personalities.
That's fine.
What I would really like to ask the gentleman that's saying that the law says this and that, I know there has to be laws, but do they think that the enemy is abiding by all the laws that they feel that the United States men and women should abide by?
Dixon.
Well, just if the enemy doesn't follow the law, it doesn't give us the excuse not to follow the law. I think the question here is the American people deserve a conversation if we're going to go to war in other countries. And if we're going to go to war, that dictates a set of rules under the laws of war. If we are invoking a security defense, then that also invokes certain rules that we should abide by. Part of this goes to the previous caller's question about the golden rule. is that if we are going to expect other nations to follow those rules, and if we're going to have the moral grounds to assert that those are the laws that we should follow, then we need to follow them ourselves.
It sounds as though everybody is saying there really are no laws in place regarding the use of drones. Dan Green.
Well, I think one of our guests here said already that they often have teams of lawyers with them, which suggests there is some law they're having to abide by.
What law?
I mean, there are certainly rules of engagement they have to follow about when to use these drones and when not to use them, what constitutes, you know, civilian casualties, things like that. So there are rules. I mean, it's, you know, the more fundamental question that the drone issue is wrapped in inside of is to sort of, when is it appropriate for the United States to go to war? When do you declare war? Things of that nature. I mean, drones is just one of a number of tools, again, to do that. But
they are different from the rules, perhaps, we've had in the past. Daniel Green, he's at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. Short break, and when we come back, more of your calls, your comments.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by American University, by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives at gatesfoundation.org, by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need, on the web at rwjf.org. And by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. This is NPR.
A novel about two girls with the same father. One knows, the other doesn't. Exploring the cascading psychological effects of family secrets. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. Welcome back. We're talking about the use of drones, not only in warfare, but as our listener David in Indianapolis points out, he says, I just heard on NPR that Texas officials are asserting that there has been increased violence along the U.S.-Mexican border that's spilling into the state of Texas. Are we using drones to spot human traffickers, drug smugglers crossing our borders? I would think drones could help us better target our border control resources where they can have the greatest impact. Christine.
I think the answer is yes. There are domestic uses of these drones. A couple of months ago, there was this really puzzling case. A drone from Mexico was actually downed on our side of the border. And unfortunately, you know, the American media often with these stories doesn't really follow through. So I never actually learned what was the origin of that drone. Was it official Mexican government? There was some speculation about potentially the the cartel. You could also imagine the cartels wanting to check the delivery of their own products, making sure they get to market. So, you know, this I think we're going to be in this place where we're going to see increased domestic use of drones. I'm really glad that during the discussion you'd mentioned a note about the surveillance of our troops using drones. I think one of the interesting things about the drone debate is that we really only have been focusing upon it as a use of ordnance delivery. We haven't talked about the utility of drones in monitoring potential human rights violations on a grotesque scale. One of the participants in your panel talked about what would have happened had we had drones during the Rwanda genocide. So I think there's a much larger debate to be had about the roles of drones domestically, non-militarized use. But I think one of the questions that remain, and this is particularly the case in Pakistan, is that there's really no transparency. Especially the drone operations that are intelligence-led, we don't know anything about them. The American citizens don't. The Pakistanis don't. Both of our governments are colluding in a fiction. And so I think one of the issues for public policy and debate is that what Shane had discussed, that the market is going to put technologies out there. They're going to create a need for a technology, and that's going to happen at a pace which will far exceed our ability to manage and to discuss the ethics and the legal considerations around these new technologies.
Right. Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, there will be a domestic implementation of drones beyond anything we're even imagining right now. You know, the FAA is actively looking at changing airspace regulations to accommodate and to assimilate unmanned systems into the airspace. You know, wrap your head around this idea that in 5 to 10 years, a lot of smart people think that FedEx and UPS will stop using manned planes to deliver cargo. Is it possible that we will that a traffic helicopter pilot will no longer be a job description that anyone recognizes? We have implementations right now going on at the border, looking at using very small drones that look like birds to monitor trafficking across the border and security there. It is happening, and once it does sort of unleash, that commercial sort of energy will, I think, eclipse any of the uses we're seeing the military use them for right now.
Let's go to Chesterfield, Missouri. Good morning, Charles.
Howdy. What rules are there that says that the FBI cannot use Terminator robots, surveillance robots, flying surveillance robots in, say, Waco, Texas?
Christine.
I'm not sure I'm the right person to take that question.
Who is?
Well, there's a question about whether or not law enforcement can use these drones now. They certainly want to. They would be used primarily, I would think, first in you hear a lot of talk about like in hostage rescue standoffs, creating drones that could the size of spiders that could like sort of skitter up into a windowsill and look inside who's in the building. You get into a different situation when you're talking about drones sort of going out and generally looking for people and for bad activity. But broadly within law enforcement, that's what they do right now, right? They go out and they police. The police go out on the street and look for things that are happening. Whether or not you could use a drone to spy inside somebody's house without cause, I think, would implicate things like the Fourth Amendment. But I think, make no mistake, law enforcement wants this technology. They know what it can be used for.
Dixon.
So you're looking at two different models. One is the law enforcement model that Shane was describing. I think there is still an open question that the CIA is using drones and is actually conducting the strikes in Yemen, which seems much more like a military function. And I don't think the administration has been clear about those different roles and whether or not the same rules are being applied in each circumstance.
Well, what was it that President Obama's counterterrorism advisor, John Brennan, outlined the other day?
Well, John Brennan outlined the new counterterrorism strategy, and part of that counterterrorism strategy is a multi-layered approach and counterterrorism response, and that we should use all the tools that are available to the government.
Including drones.
Including drones, yes. But the core values that are driving it are include a respect for human rights as well as a respect for the rule of law.
To San Antonio, Texas. Good morning, Bobby.
Yeah, my brother-in-law is a drone pilot for the Air Force, and I didn't really know a whole lot about the program until talking to him about it, and we also use, you know, drones in combat, you know, for live feeds to the troops where, Air Force combat controllers will have like toughbook laptops where they can see a live feed of the battlefield and where the enemy positions are. You know, we don't just use them just to take lives, but we use them to save the lives of our troops.
Shane.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, predominantly the drones are being used for surveillance right now. And it's worth noting that, you know, the Defense Science Board actually just released a paper not long ago saying that the amount of intelligence, the imagery, the signals intelligence, all the stuff that these drones are sucking up is essentially overwhelming to analysts, you know, who are looking at this. So our capacity to collect information, as the caller suggests, it's just extraordinary. I mean, there's more than we could ever look at.
So right now, we have more than 50 countries who have purchased surveillance drones. Now, what's between a surveillance drone and a drone, a weaponized drone? How far is the distance between those two technologies, Shane?
It's not inconsiderable. I mean, it's not to say that you can just slap a missile on it and, you know, it'll fly around just fine. I mean, we still have the technological edge when it comes to weaponized systems, and we exert very strong export controls on the companies who make these drones, and we don't share them.
But other countries are developing their own.
Sure, absolutely. The Chinese are definitely developing these. Our allies already have some of the Predator systems that we use. The British have them. The Italians have them. I believe the Turks have them. You know, it's only a matter of time, though. I mean, in all of these discussions, the technological hurdles are not that significant.
Dan, yeah. I know you wanted to say something earlier.
Well, just going back to the president's counterterrorism strategy, it's interesting, too. Drones are relatively inexpensive, at least cheaper than having to train a pilot and provide him or her a fighter jet. But I think a lot of reasons that the drones are becoming more popular as well is we have these difficult economic times. Many European countries, for example, are cutting their militaries fairly substantially. And this seems to be sort of a inexpensive solution, quote unquote, for a variety of ills, not just military technology advancing. And I think one of the challenges we have is to not mistake this platform as a panacea for solutions that are actually far more difficult. For example, the president's counterterrorism strategy absolutely is correct in saying we need a holistic approach, which means, you know, governance, development, reconstruction, these types of things. But it's those particular elements of that strategy, governance and development, that are actually the weakest. You know, the drones are our strongest muscle.
They're already out there.
Well, they're there, but they're not well organized to do these kinds of things. They're not well resourced. There's not great political consensus often for that kind of development spending. And to be frank, the State Department was designed to address problems of a different era. Some of these challenges fall between these sort of conventional civil military tasks and how we've typically done business. And that's sort of the challenge, I think.
And where is that kind of consensus likely to fall? Where is it going to come from? Are we talking about congressional debates? What are we talking about?
Well, I think that the challenge of so much of our conflicts in Iraq and Afghanistan generally is we have institutions, whether military, intelligence, development, diplomacy, that were all designed to fight different things, principally conventional war, finding intelligence, doing diplomatic relations with nation states. And they're confronted with challenges that are completely inconsistent with that. A decentralized, locally based insurgency, for example, that blends seamlessly, you know, kinetic or non-kinetic approaches. You know, that's really a challenge for bureaucracies when they're trying to adjust to these things. And the problem is that as much as we have learned from these wars, as much as we have adapted to them, the roots of sort of reform are very shallow. Because these great drivers of the status quo are there. For every drone contract, which is so many millions of dollars, it's like a rounding error for a cruise or a battleship. And then those things drive constituencies.
Sure.
And that's the great thing about, or the unfortunate challenge of insurgency generally. It's not well-funded. It's hard. It takes a long time. It's very labor-intensive if you want to do it the right way. And there are no technological fixes, which is often an American approach to how we solve problems.
Dixon.
We're approaching 10 years after 9/11, I think, is a perfect opportunity to take a look back and determine what our path forward is. Secretary Clinton and former Secretary Gates have actually used their bully pulpits to talk about a reallocation of resources toward what they call smart power, which means an allocation toward diplomacy, toward development, as well as defense. And those three things need to work together more seamlessly. What we've seen over the last decade is that the Department of Defense budget has increased dramatically and the State Department's budget has declined. And so both of them, from the defense side and the diplomacy side, have said we need to revisit the strategy.
To Ann Arbor, Michigan. Philippe, you're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. I had a quick comment. I wanted to say that are we prepared to open this Pandora's box? You know, in a hypothetical scenario in the future, we could have, you know, drones that are immune to death in the form of they can't be harmed by radiation. They could harmlessly use X-rays to find and kill targets. They could be nuclear powered. They could even be prohibitively lethal on the battlefield. They can be endlessly upgraded. They can be concealed and even assembled anywhere, you know. So it seems to me that in the battlefield of the future, where humans have no place, are we ready and willing to open such an ante?
Shane.
I think this is the big ethical question in the long term. I mean, particularly as we design drones that are more autonomous, if you listen to futurists, right, who sort of sound these alarm bells about robotic technology, you would believe that the day would come when the robots start thinking for themselves and turn against us. And it sounds somewhat fantastic, but there are real nuggets of truth in that to explore.
Give me an example.
Well, I mean, there people talk about self-replicating nanotechnology and the idea that this technology would suddenly go out and start, you know, healing itself, replicating itself, and then taking over everything in sight and sort of working independently from us. It's sort of a nightmare kind of, you know, people have used the word Terminator robot kind of vision. But again, it's instructive. Right? I mean, this is something that, you know, ethicists have to grapple with. The military, I'm not sure whether or not they see the long-term implications of this or are more interested sort of in developing technology to meet the requirements that they have now. That seems to be what's really happening, what's driving the discussion now.
Just real quick, there will always be a need for combat infantrymen. I mean, I'm not one, but I absolutely recognize their value. And it's like the last thing people ever sort of fund. They don't have big contractors to support infantrymen. You know, and there, those at the end of the day, you do need boots on the ground in many situations.
Daniel Green of the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's go to Ozark, Arkansas. Good morning, Mike.
Good morning, Diane. I was just wondering, with the present technology, how effective would they be against a more sophisticated enemy? Somebody with, you know, just not terrorists running around the ground, but another country with some sort of countermeasure. Would it be hard to deal with?
Christine.
Well, I mean, we're kind of perhaps coming to that issue with Pakistan. In the Pakistan case in particular, they went the drones where it in fact is targeting our mutual enemies. But there are a bunch of folks that we would like to target with those drones. For example, the Haqqani network, which is very much Pakistan's allies. So we may actually sort of be in that zone where we're going to find this out. But I'm not really sure I'm the best person to answer this question. But I don't. One of the issues that drones raise for me is this notion of stability. So, for example, how does this affect the rules of engagement? At what level of conflict can drones engage in where countries are not technically at war? I mean, I think there's some really interesting revolutions in military technology and the way they affect countries engage that we probably should be thinking about now before we actually have this technology that can do that.
It's interesting because as you talk about China developing its own drones, I mean, it sounds as though there could be more than little competition going on there in terms of effectiveness, in terms of ability to strike a desired target and so on, Shane.
That's right. I mean, the Chinese have, like I said, we said earlier, really announced their intention to field a fleet of drones that can go out and attack U.S. carrier groups. And that might seem sort of fanciful right now, given where their technology is, but that's not so unthinkable, really, in the near future. We will then develop countermeasures to that. We'll build drones to hit their drones. We'll build longer range drones so that our carrier groups can stay further offshore. This is always this way with the evolution of military technology. But we should not be so arrogant, I think, in this country to presume that we will be the only ones who develop robotic armies. This is the future, not just for us. It's the future for a lot of countries.
But Dan Green, I want to go back to something you said, that the U.S. military, the individual personnel, will always be part of the equation. If you've got this drone warfare going on, don't you take people out off the ground?
Well, you know, for example, you know, when there was the uprising in Iraq in 1920, you know, and the British drew down their large, you know, conventional forces, what they had essentially were drones for their time. They had robust air assets, and they had a ground intelligence network of people who literally would live amongst the tribes. And if the tribes sort of revolted, they would literally get in the cockpit of the plane and guide the pilot around where to shoot. You know, sort of drones of that period of time. You will always have to have people on the ground. There's a lot of technological means we can acquire intelligence, but at the end of the day, you do need people, not large numbers, but you need them there.
Daniel Green, C. Dixon Osborne, Christine Fair, Shane Harris. Very, very interesting. Thank you so much. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, Monique Nazareth, and Sarah Ashworth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Katie June Friesen answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, transcripts, podcasts, and CD sales. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. And we're on Facebook and Twitter. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.